From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This Labor Day weekend, we're revisiting our interview with Greg Whiteley, the filmmaker behind the Netflix series Cheer, which scored 6 Emmy nominations, including one for Best Unstructured Reality Program. Cheer became a pop cultural moment. Many of the cast became minor celebrities, and the show counted Reese Witherspoon and Chrissy Teigen among its fans. Cheer depicts the grueling world of competitive community college cheerleading in a small Texas town. The series delves into the sometimes heartbreaking backstories of the young competitors as they vie for a spot on the mat. The situations can be sensitive, and earlier this year, Whiteley told me he still has misgivings about the way he depicted one set of very driven parents. Are they mad at you?
Yeah, I think they are. And I called them right after I started reading online what people were saying about them. And I just asked, are you all right?
Whiteley also talks about how he cast the hit documentary with very little information on the competitors. And he gets into the drama that happened on and off screen while he was making the series. But first on the news banter, Tenet marches into theaters, Mulan stays with streaming. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. So, Warner Brothers has been on a roller coaster of trying to open Christopher Nolan's Tenet. And Christopher Nolan, as we know, insists on a theatrical opening. Don't even say the words premium video on demand to him. So Warner Brothers postponed it, and then they set it and they opened it overseas, and the early numbers are good. And it's this weekend was the debut in the United States. I don't think Warner's was looking for the kind of blockbuster number you normally would see from that kind of tentpole film, but just enough to make it creditable. And as they are pitching this, and as we are speaking, come reports that Robert Pattinson has tested positive for coronavirus. This has been reported. We don't know more. We hope for the best for him, of course. And The Batman, which is a Warner Brothers movie that had been shooting in London, had to shut down. And that is a tricky message when you're asking people to go into theaters. And it also raises questions. You can imagine the protocols that I'm assuming were in place, and nonetheless, this happened.
Yeah, I mean, this is a PR disaster for Warner Brothers, because their messaging and the messaging of the theater owners that have been pushing to reopen and to get people back into theaters is, you know, we've taken precautions. This is just as safe as going to Costco. This is, you know, we have to get things moving again and get theaters back open. And then boom, the day that the big movie goes into theaters, one of its stars is now testing positive for coronavirus. It's just a bad look for what's going on. But it also highlights some of these challenges that Hollywood is dealing with. I mean, if Robert Pattinson can test positive for coronavirus, given all the millions of dollars that are being spent on the Batman to safety proof the set and to quarantine people and to have sanitation processes and keep people in a bubble, if he tests positive, what does that say about, you know, the random CBS sitcom that's trying to restart, or the talk show, or any of these other things that are going on? And I think it's just going to set the movement to reopen back.
We'll see. We don't have the numbers as we're talking, and we are going to be watching, but Warner Brothers is going to be very calculated and not release them in the normal traditional way, because this isn't normal and traditional. And I will note that we talked to the person, Ann Sarnoff, who had been chair of Warner Brothers and has now been promoted to this huge job overseeing all the Warner Media content at HBO Max and the film and TV studio. She said that she went to Tenet herself, to a screening of Tenet in Connecticut, and just found it to be very rewarding and very safe feeling, just in case you were wondering.
We'll talk to her in 3 weeks.
We'll see. We'll hope that there's no news there. Meanwhile, you know, Disney has put Mulan this same weekend, another $200 million plus movie, on demand, a premium video on demand. So if you are a Disney Plus subscriber, you get to pay $30 and see Mulan. And we got this Labor Day weekend, unclear. Hopefully people are observing protocols and not running around and making bad decisions. How many people are going to be willing to pay that? Disney is interested in those numbers. Everybody will be interested in those numbers. I don't know that Disney will be sharing those numbers with us, though.
Yeah, this is the great experiment, because Disney has made a calculated decision here to create a window, essentially. They've created this premium on demand window within the Disney Plus universe. And that's a big difference from the model that a lot of these other streamers have presented at Netflix and at HBO Max, where if you pay your money, you get access to all the movies and content and shows that they put up on the platform. Disney is carving out a VIP section, so to speak, for this movie. Pay $30, get it in this window of 3 months before it becomes available to all Disney Plus subscribers in December. And that's the question right now, is how many people are going to be willing to pay the upcharge for access right now rather than wait to get it later? And, you know, the answer to that question, I think, will determine a lot about how these big budget movies are released in the future, because as we've talked about many times, the economics don't quite work if you're going to pay $200 million to produce a film and put it on a streaming service. But if you can get that extra window where you can generate tens of millions of dollars in a premium window, maybe it does make sense.
Yeah, I mean, bear in mind that this is supposed to be a family movie, which, as you know, as a dad of a little kid, yeah, the pressure is on to find something to watch. You know, Christopher Nolan certainly has a devoted fan base. What constitutes success for Warners in this context? I don't know whether they want to just get out. I think they want to get out, honestly, with their pride intact and with the idea that the strategy isn't a complete fail. And I don't know what that number is in their minds, but they are stressing, as we just recently talked to this Ann Sarnoff, who runs the thing, they are just stressing that they're going to play this thing for weeks, and it's not the old world where the big opening weekend matters. And we've only got about 60% of theaters open, even if people choose to go, with diminished capacity. So, you know, they're certainly touting that they made $57 million overseas already. And, you know, I will note both of these movies have release dates in China, and that will help them to some degree because, you know, China's a really big market and it has been popping lately. However, you know, they only get, at best, if it's a co-venture, 25% of the money. You know, you don't get that kind of that full flow as you would from the U.S. box office and other places.
Yeah, and we're taping this before the picture of the opening weekend is clear in the U.S., but let's say a Chris Nolan movie opens to about 50 plus million typically. If Warners can get to 20, 25 with this half capacity, I think they would be happy this weekend. And then, as Ann Sarnoff says, it is going to play a lot longer, I think, because there's nothing else. And there's, you know, if more theaters start to reopen, there's going to be more access to this market. And I think there will be people that are less inclined to go opening weekend because they fear crowds, that might be inclined to go maybe on a Tuesday at noon if there's an opportunity to do that.
So by the time some of you are listening to this, we will know these numbers, not as we, Matt and I, are talking. And we'll just also know that it's not this news about Robert Pattinson. It's not the only news. Dwayne Johnson has reported that he and his family were positive for COVID-19. This is something where it's going to be, I think, comparable with maybe, in the worst case, schools, colleges, where there's this, you know, sports, there's a fitful opening. So far, there's been nothing traced to a theatrical release in terms of overseas. But again, those countries have done better than the U.S. in terms of containing this virus by a long shot. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The Emmys are on the horizon, though this year, of course, the awards show will look a little different. One series with a bunch of shots at a win is Cheer, directed by Greg Whiteley. The show is up for 6 nominations, including Outstanding Unstructured Reality Program. It also received nods for directing and cinematography. Cheer was acclaimed when it came out this January for its depiction of a grueling and often overlooked sport, community college cheerleading. 40 kids were vying for a place on the mat as Navarro College in Corsicana, Texas, sought its 14th national championship. Here, Morgan Siminer talks about assumptions people make about the challenging and risky sport.
There's a lot of stereotypes that go on with cheerleading. People think that we're dumb blondes. People think that we just do, like, cheers, like, go team, stuff like that. But we actually put our bodies in a lot of pain.
Oh! Sorry. Are you okay, Morgan?
Greg Whiteley has made something of a career out of directing films that find compelling characters in competitions for young adults. He also created Netflix's Last Chance U, which follows competitive junior college football programs that give troubled kids a shot at getting their lives on track. When I talked to Whiteley earlier this year, I asked him how he found his compelling principal players.
The choices that you make, you know, you get a group of kids, and this applies to cheer as well. Your strategy for doing it, figuring out who are we following. Do you make that decision at the beginning, in the middle, at the end?
Here's probably the best way I could answer. Ira Glass, I love This American Life.
I did not
life.
See that coming. I just
really?
Want to say. But now that you say it, I say, okay, Ira Glass.
Well, I was very nervous when I was making New York Doll, my first movie. I'd never done a documentary. And I thought, well, how do you do this? And I was such a fan of Ira Glass, and we lived nearish to Royce Hall. My wife and I went and saw him speak. He started describing a filmmaker where a woman went into a high school and she filmed for a year, and she followed two or three students. And one of these students had an incredible story. She got pregnant her senior year, all of the drama around that. It ended up being this incredible movie that Ira was really impressed with. And he asked this filmmaker, how did you know to follow her? And we had a similar conundrum. Every college that we've gone to, whether for football and Last Chance U or most recently with cheer, you have a number of people who are volunteering to be your main subject. They want to be filmed.
I mean, do you start out saying, which one of you really would like to be spotlighted in this thing?
We never do that.
Okay.
Because everyone would raise their hand.
I would imagine.
With the exception of just one or two.
Right. The ones you probably want.
Yes, that's right. A lot of times that's true. But what this woman said to Ira, and then Ira repeated at Royce Hall, she said, I started just hanging out with these people. And in hanging out with them, it's almost like that experience you have when you're at a cocktail party. You are mixing and mingling, and there is just one or two people that you seem to keep circling back to. There's something you have in common. There's some level of interest. And that's how she picked this girl, and it's how I've learned to pick main subjects that we're focusing on. We've got a team. You know, it takes an army of people to make a documentary series, given the short amount of time that you have to film and the number of hours you have to deliver to Netflix to produce a series. But all of us, we will come together every night, particularly that first week of filming. I will typically say, here's who I like. And there are a few key people whose opinions I really trust. And if I can sense that I can sell them, then I now have
you
confidence
mean your group.
That we can go,
like,
yeah, within the group.
Sometimes people might be like, eh, or, oh yeah, her.
Yeah. And if they kind of go, eh, I know I either have some work to do or I've picked the wrong person, but I've noticed that usually is not the case. It's pretty obvious to the three or four of us that are making that decision. It becomes really clear. There may be people on the periphery that people will try and lobby. And in the interest of just hedging our bets, we'll go, okay, well, let's kind of follow them. But in the 6 years now they're doing it, it's always the same four or five people that we mentioned in the first meeting or two.
Wow.
It's always those four or five people.
First instinct is correct,
I guess. Or it's maybe if I were to choose four or five other people, human beings just tend to be interesting. And when you invest that kind of time in them, you're going to find something great about it.
Well, I thought you could, you know, this rival school for Navarro, which is 40 miles away or something. I thought it's clear, it seems, you know, you could just as easily have flipped a coin and said, I'll go there.
Uh-huh.
Is that true? You're smiling because, of course, we wonder whether that's going to happen.
It might.
It might. But I don't know whether there was a reason that you met Monica, the coach, or obviously those two schools are the schools.
Yeah.
Was there a reason you went to Navarro first?
Well, the president of the school wouldn't let us come to TVCC. So that's the first reason.
Let that out.
Yeah. But the second reason was Monica. I just met Monica and I knew that that's who I wanted to hang out with. I just knew that that's where I wanted to spend time. There was a really interesting collision between her grit and competitiveness and a deep sense of caring for her team that I thought, I know this will be great.
I'm not going to give away much at all for people who haven't seen cheer, but one of the cheerleaders who very talented and you feel like this girl is somebody they're going to really rely on. And then, oops, she's out of the picture because she's injured. And I don't know if you had said, we're going to follow her. And then suddenly she couldn't. I mean, there's drama, obviously, because she's no longer able to compete. Just adjust and say, well, can't stay with her.
She was not one of the main five. No, we really liked her. But for whatever reason, there were five people that jumped. And I think if I was committed to those five. And whether they made it throughout the whole season or not is inconsequential to us. I think it's still something interesting. If somebody is, their hopes and dreams come down to making it on the mat and being there in Daytona, but they get injured, that's still a worthwhile story to tell. I mean, you can still cut away to them during Daytona as they're off the mat. And right. That's just as poignant a shot as them nailing their stunt on the mat.
So when you have these kids, do you tell them, like, we will follow you everywhere? Or do they have the ability and do they exercise that to say, you know what, we're not down for you to be here right now?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we would never go anywhere where we were not welcome. Anybody at any time could say, hey, you know, not today. And that happened a lot.
That does happen.
Oh, for sure. That's, yeah, I think that may be the key difference between reality TV and docuseries. In reality TV, at least presumably, you're paying those people. And with that pay, that compromises the relationship to a degree where they now feel obligated to do the things that you would need them to do to produce drama. We feel differently. We want you to treat us as you would a reporter for the New York Times. We're coming in and we're going to document this story as much as you're willing to allow us to. But at any point, if you're not comfortable with the process or even on a particular day you're not comfortable, you just say stop. And we always explain that at the top. We only want to be around at the degree that you are comfortable with us being around.
Now, some of these kids, I mean, they all have these amazing backstories. Hard in some cases. Well, I think all of them in different ways hard. You go to Wyoming. Do you go once? Do you go in the beginning, the middle? Do you go twice? What do you do?
We only had the money to go once to Wyoming. And we only had the money really to make a small handful of visits to the five that we were following. And even of all five, we couldn't go as often as we wanted. We went twice to Chicago, where Jerry is from. We went once to Florida, where we could do both Ladarius and Gabby. And then we did a follow-up shoot in Florida. But that's all the money we had. I would love to do more. I wish we could do more home visits.
Yeah, I wonder whether the purse strings ever loosen on that one.
Yeah.
Well, this may not be the time when Netflix is loosening purse strings, but I'll say that. You don't have to. Coming up after a short break, more from our interview with cheer director Greg Whiteley. He'll get into what he wishes he could change about his 6-time Emmy-nominated show. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The Emmys are coming up, so this Labor Day, we're rebroadcasting our interview with Greg Whiteley, director and executive producer of the Netflix series Cheer. It's up for 6 awards at this year's ceremony. Cheer dives into the grueling world of competitive community college cheerleading, showing the punishing practices that go into the dangerous but impressive stunts. The main subjects in Cheers have become celebrities of sorts after the show blew up, among them Gabby Butler. Even before the show premiered, she had a big social media following. She now has 1.7 million followers on Instagram alone. Cheer portrays Butler's parents as relentless micromanagers, pushing their daughter to make appearances across the country, take sponsorship deals, and even lose weight. For Butler, cheer is not just about business opportunities.
The feeling of going out on the floor and performing that 2.5-minute routine. It's like this adrenaline rush that you get that you're just like, wow. It's scary, but you just have to trust your teammates.
Still, cheer is a business and not just for the competitors themselves. There's also a sort of a lesson in capitalism in the series because this company, Varsity Sports, controls so much about cheerleading and they restrict your ability to shoot the ultimate competition. And yet, I guess their CEO sits for an interview. Is that who you had?
Yeah, the CEO, Bill Seeley, I called him right when I knew we would be making a series. And he was understandably guarded. And he explained to me, we've allowed other doc film crews or reality TV crews to come and film. And we've never been happy with the way cheerleaders are portrayed. And I started to walk him through. And to his credit, he went and watched Last Chance U, and the conversations got better. He started to say, oh, okay, I can see that you guys are real filmmakers. You're interested in telling the real story. We still have some reservations about if you were to come with this full crew, we've got hundreds of teams that are there competing. You're going to be in the way. I kept trying to explain to him, no, I know we can get this done. After I went to Daytona and I realized the Swiss watch that is the Daytona end of the year championship, it is hundreds of teams that compete and it is controlled chaos. And I can imagine, I don't think anybody should be blaming Varsity Sports for not wanting us to come and film. The thing that was disappointing to me is I really felt like we were very close to having some agreement that would allow us to go there. And at the last minute, I think they just got cold feet. They started adding on extra restrictions with just days to go. I don't even know if Bill Seeley was busy planning the competition. It was we were dealing with his lawyers. And, you know, for them, they look at it and they go, well, what's in it for us? There's nothing in this for us. Why should we allow you? It's only downside for us. And I think that was the logic behind at the end. We could not meet their demands, which included an element of creative control. They would have say over how the footage was used. That's, and I could never allow that.
Cannot happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, unfortunately, those talks broke down and we weren't allowed to have our cameras film that championship, which we had been building the whole year for.
So did you have this moment where you're like, oh, my God,
yeah.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, I thought, yeah, this is maybe the end of
this
my
is a
career.
Killer, right, yeah. A killer for the series. I would imagine how much panic there would be, really. Like, and
yeah.
Then, so you just say to people, get out your phones?
No, here's what we did. In doing our research and trying to explain to Varsity what kind of footprint we would need, I just started looking at any kind of footage I could find online of past championships. And there was a ton. Looking through all this footage, it occurred to us, we could just take footage that people uploaded with their phones and we could pretty much cobble together the Daytona experience. And so that's what we did.
Going forward, assuming there's going to be another season of this, which has not at this moment been announced.
Yeah, still working that through.
But I just see a company that has a lot of control over a lot of aspects of cheer seeing an opportunity, and I wonder how that will play itself out.
I do too. Their argument would be they have built a very successful company that they will tell you, we have done a lot to put cheerleading on the map, and we have a lot invested in this activity, and so we just have to be very careful. I mean, if I'm being honest, they're probably as controlling as I would be tempted to be if the shoe was on the other foot. I get it. What I hope is they'll see that being open with a filmmaker like myself and a filmmaking team like the one we have is really going to only grow the pie, I believe. Most people don't know cheerleading. They don't understand it.
This is done more for cheerleading, people understanding it than anything I can think of.
I think so too.
You know, there's a parent or two where fans of the show are like, geez, and when you must know when you're shooting them that they're going to play
Talking about Gabby's parents.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gabby!
This rice
did you make the video?
No, I need to make it.
Really? Seriously?
I told you.
Okay, I need that tonight. I have to send it to her.
Okay.
You need to stop procrastinating on stuff. You had all day long to do it.
Okay, but...
Okay. You have no defense when you start with okay, so just shut up at that point and say I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll be honest with you, I owe them an apology. I think that there is a way that I have made movies in the past where a main subject or somebody I'm following around will say or do something that either makes them look silly or conniving, and I don't shy away from showing that stuff, but what I try and do is spend enough time with them that I could give a greater context to who they really are. And so that instead of just dismissing them, you as an audience will watch them and go, well, you know, am I kind of like that? I might be kind of like that. I shouldn't judge this person that harshly. And so I feel like that's a way, as a storyteller, I can have my cake and eat it too, where I want to have those moments that are funny or...
I mean, I don't know if you affirmatively say somebody's the bad guy because it's more drama.
Well, it's a very cheap way to move a story forward. If you can find somebody to root against, that's a shortcut almost invariably to creating empathy for your protagonist, for your main character, who you want the audience to root for. I think there's a better way. I think even villains become more interesting when you understand why they do what they do.
So you owe them an apology because...
Well, here's what's hard.
I mean, they had more than one bite at the apple in this series, and every time the apple has a little bit of a worm in it, I think.
To a degree. But I like them. I truly enjoy their company. I think they're crazy.
Are they mad at you?
Yeah, I think they are. I've had enough conversations with them since it's come out. And I called them right after I started reading online what people were saying about them. And I just asked, are you all right?
Aside from the show itself, their daughter has a huge social media following. So they get a double-barreled social media blowback, I'm assuming. But go ahead.
Yes, I think that's right. But I think what I regret the most is my true feelings for them as people didn't come out in three dimensions in our telling of their story. I don't know how I would have done it differently because 6 hours seems like a long time, but it's not. I mean, you really have to hit your marks. And if you're not a main character, you're not getting a lot of time on camera. They got a fair amount of time, but they were largely used to help move Gabby's story forward. And I think what they would argue, and I think they'd be right, is, hey, we let you into our home. You filmed a whole dinner. You saw how much love Gabby has for us and how much we have for her. His argument was, people are accusing me of using my daughter. I'm living off my daughter's income. I have a very successful business. That doesn't come out. I haven't taken one dime of my daughter's. And he's 100% right about that.
It's true. I didn't know that he had a very successful business. That's not to say that they don't drive her very hard.
Yeah, no, true. And I assume he had a successful business. I'm only going on what he's told me. And we did visit him in his office.
There was an office.
I didn't go through the books, right. So I don't know. But I believe him when he says he's not taking his daughter's money. So I think you're fair as an audience member to saying they are what they call very sticky parents. They're very involved in Gabby's life. They will micromanage this girl. But, you know, I'm not Gabby's dad. I don't know Gabby the way he would know her. I can easily sit back and judge. What I think I could have done a better job as a storyteller and fleshing out the other elements of them. One thing that is admirable about them is they do spend a lot of time together. Mm. I know for a fact that he has anonymously paid the tuition of other cheerleaders on the team who couldn't pay their tuition.
Wow.
And he's probably pretty mad at me that I wouldn't include that detail. And the only reason, I just don't know how to include it. If it's anonymous, that's one. But also, I don't know how I would tell it. I don't know who he paid that tuition for. It was told to me by somebody else. And so, yeah, I lament. Everybody I film, I would want them to have me back. And so far, that has been true. And I hope it's true for them because I want to make it right.
Right? So at least she's not back at Novara.
We just got word last week. She's coming back.
She's coming back. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if we're coming back, but if we are, I want to.
Greg Whiteley is the director and executive producer of Cheer and Last Chance U on Netflix. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I spoke with Greg Whiteley at the beginning of this year. It's still not clear whether or when there will be a season 2. In an interview with The Hollywood Reporter, Whiteley said, "We were, of course, exploring the possibility of doing a second season, but the coronavirus, for obvious reasons, complicated all that. I would love to keep filming those people, but I don't really have any good answers at this point. And neither do the rest of us." That's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program with help from Kat Yore. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.